Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 65. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and it's great to have your company. Before we dive into this week's episode, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast, and thank all of my listeners who've taken the time to rate and review the show. Not only are your kind words a great source of encouragement, but they also help new listeners find the podcast. Another way you can support the work I do is by becoming a Talking Tudors patron. It's super easy to do. Just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. February's prize is a copy of Uncrowned Queen, The Fateful Life of Margaret Beaufort, Tudor Matriarch by Dr. Nicola Tallis. Thank you to Michael O'Mara Books for sponsoring this wonderful prize. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about her debut novel is Nikki Marmory. For many years, Nikki worked as a financial journalist, editing magazines about credit and foreign exchange trading. But the financial crisis, followed swiftly by the arrival of three small children, put an end to that, and now she writes historical fiction from a rural village in Buckinghamshire. On Wilder Seas is Nikki's debut novel, which comes out in the UK on March 16th, 2020 with Legend Press. Inspired by the true story of Maria, the woman who sailed on the Golden Hind during Francis Drake's famous circumnavigation voyage, it's the tale of one woman's quest for freedom. My conversation with Nikki straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sayles. Welcome to Talking Tudors. Nikki, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on the podcast and chat and talk tutors with us.
Oh, it's a very great pleasure.
Fantastic. Why don't we begin with you introducing yourself to our listeners and just telling them a little bit about yourself?
Yeah. Well, I'm a first-time author. This is my first novel. I've spent the past 7 years researching and writing it. It's called On Wild Seas, and it's the story of Maria, who was the only woman on the Golden Hind when Sir Francis Drake sailed around the world. It's a fictional exploration of her life. It's about the possibilities of her life, in which I use the facts of Drake's voyage as the pillars of the story, and where I've invented a story around Maria in the space around those pillars. She's not there in the accounts we have of the voyage, although we know she was there. And this is my attempt, really, to put her back in. So that's the novel. But my background is financial journalism. I spent many years editing magazines about niche financial markets. And so that's what I did in my day job until the financial crash, really. I used to edit a magazine about credit derivatives, and it was credit derivatives that sort of brought the whole financial system crashing down in 2008. It's not my fault.
No.
But that's what it was, my day job before this.
Did you always have an interest in Tudor history, or is this something fairly new for you?
Well, I studied history at university, but I did more modern history. I took some early modern courses, but it wasn't really my passion. And really, it's Maria's story that attracted me to spending this time researching and wanting to write this novel. So it was very much a case of being drawn to the story by Maria rather than the period. But I do have a sort of a strange, weird sort of fascination with Francis Drake. And I think that's sort of been a lifelong sort of background obsession, really. There are so many strange coincidences and ways in which I've sort of rubbed up against, you know, places that he's been sort of over the course of my life. So, for example, when I got married at Middle Temple Hall in London, and that has a very strong Drake connection. We know he dined there. We've got accounts of him coming into the hall one night, and everyone's extremely excited to see him and sort of, you know, stood up, and great applause and great merriment that he was there. And the hall where I celebrated my wedding, it has a table that's made from the planks of the Golden Hind. And it used to have the ship's lantern from the Golden Hind until the Blitz. So they now have a replacement of the ship's lantern. So there are these very strange sort of coincidences where I've been in places where Drake was. Sort of almost feels like he's been tapping me on my shoulder throughout my life. So I think there's a sort of a very strange connection there.
It's fascinating. Now, I'd love to hear more about Maria. So you've mentioned that she's the woman who sailed on the Golden Hind during that circumnavigation voyage in 1579. When did you actually first come across her story, and what do we know of her life?
Well, I first read about her about 7 years ago, and I was reading a social history of Elizabethan life, and it mentioned her. And it was very much a throwaway comment. You know, it was one line in a larger piece about the Golden Hind and about Drake's circumnavigation. And it just mentioned this woman who was on board for 9 months, and the fact that she was abandoned, heavily pregnant, on a desert island in Indonesia. And, you know, that very much made me want to investigate further, because that's quite a horrific thing to read. So it made me want to sort of look for the original sources. And so I sought out there is one contemporary account. Well, there's two accounts, but the main account, which is an eyewitness account of Maria on board the Golden Hind, is kept at the British Library. And so I sought it out, and it's a, you know, an old curling manuscript. It's got sort of holes in the parchment where candles have burnt sparks in it over the years. And this account of Maria is very, very moving. I'll read you what it says about her. So this is from an eyewitness account from a sailor who was on board the ship, and he's explaining how Drake raided a Spanish merchant ship that they came across. And he said, "Drake took from this ship a proper Negro wench called Maria, which was afterward gotten with child between the captain and his men pirates, and set on a small island to take her adventures." So, yes, I think that is very striking and very moving, and it made me want to investigate further. So I sought out all of the original, the early accounts of Drake's voyage. And of course, she's not there, because this episode doesn't really reflect very well on Drake. So she's not in the early accounts. And a lot of the subsequent accounts are based on the early accounts. And so a lot of histories of Drake and circumnavigation over the years just don't mention her. And when they do mention her, they often don't name her, or they don't They don't go into any great detail about this quite extraordinary situation, I think. And I find that interesting, and I find that gap something that requires exploration, because, you know, I want to know about this. I want to know about this woman, this woman who was on, the only woman that we know of on an Elizabethan exploration ship, a woman who was there when Drake explored the North American coast. She was there when he set up the first colony in America, in the Americas, which was called Nova Albion. And she was there for the Pacific Crossing. And I want to know about this woman who lived this extraordinary life in such an extreme circumstance. You know, I don't know if you've ever been to the Golden Hind replica in London, but it's absolutely tiny. And
yes, I have seen it. Yeah.
Being there, you can just imagine the situation of this woman, you know, surrounded by men, not very nice men, a lot of them. And it something about that story gripped me. I couldn't really let it go. I had to pursue it. I had to know more about it. And it became a bit of an obsession, to be honest.
Well, I'd love to hear a little bit more about the research journey. It was obviously quite an intriguing journey for you. And you've mentioned, you know, the eyewitness account. I'd love to know about what other sources you used, and what were some of the highs and lows of that process?
Sure. Well, I'll run through, because the primary sources about Maria are so scarce, I can sort of run through those for you. First of all, there's the anonymous narrative, which I've mentioned, which is this account that's kept at the British Library. And the next, you know, as I said as well, when the first accounts of Drake's journey were published, she wasn't mentioned. So the first account of Drake's voyage came in 1589, and it was published in Richard Hakluyt's Principal Navigations, and Maria's not mentioned at all in that. She's not mentioned in Drake's version, which was published in 1628. But there are sort of clues about her. And one of the clues is in Shakespeare's play, The Tempest. The Tempest was first performed in 1610 or 1611. And people there would have seen this story on the stage of this African woman who was abandoned, heavily pregnant, on a deserted island. And there are some clues that is inspired by Maria, because The Tempest, there's lots of sort of strange parallels in The Tempest with Drake's voyage. And so there are some clues there that he knew that he was aware of Maria, because there certainly had been gossip circulating London about this woman, because she was also mentioned in a history book called The Annales, which was published by William Camden. And the first edition of that came out in 1615, but that was only published in Latin. So the first English version of that book came in 1625. And he mentions Maria. He talks about Drake returning from the circumnavigation, and he talks about this sort of great crime done to this woman. And he mentions that Drake had sort of returned from the circumnavigation to the admiration of all men, he says, and with no crimes laid to his charge, except that he inhumanely exposed a negress maid on an island. And so that's evidence that people in London knew about Maria at the time. And it's evidence that people at the time also, you know, thought this was a terrible thing to have done. But the next, that's pretty much it, in fact, for all the sort of mentions of Maria in the sort of early period, until about 300 years later, when an archaeologist called Zalia Nuttall discovered in the archives the depositions of John Drake. And John Drake is the nephew of Sir Francis Drake, and he served as his page on the circumnavigation voyage. He was a young boy at the time. And later, he captained his own ship in a later fleet of exploration to the Americas. And he was unfortunately captured by the Spanish on this voyage and was interrogated. And he too, in these interrogations, which were recorded by the Spanish and kept in the Spanish archives, he talks about Maria, and he talks about the fact that she was on a ship with a Spanish nobleman called Don Francisco de Zarate. And he confirms this only other eyewitness account we have of Maria. So he confirms that she joined the Golden Hind in April and was abandoned on a desert island near Indonesia 9 months later in December. So those are the sort of mentions of Maria. And there was so much to research for this book. There was, you know, I had to research about Elizabethan shipcraft. I had to look into you know, the backstory of my novel takes place on an earlier voyage, which was a voyage by John Hawkins, who's Francis Drake's cousin. And this is a horrific, horrific story, which involves a slave raid in what is now Sierra Leone. And there are eyewitness accounts of that as well. You know, one from John Hawkins himself, which is a horrifying read, and others from the sailors who were on the voyage with him. Because later on in this voyage, again, they ran into trouble with the Spanish, and John Hawkins had to abandon 100 sailors on the coast of Mexico. And some of those sailors, well, most of those sailors never made it home. Some did, and they wrote accounts of their experiences. So we have these wonderful eyewitness accounts and these narratives of life in colonial New Spain, and these eyewitness accounts of this horrific slave raid in Sierra Leone. And, you know, so they were sort of part of the research journey as well. In terms of highs and lows, really the highs were the joy of pursuing your curiosity, because this story has so many sort of interesting angles that it sent me in so many different directions. You know, it took me from West Africa to the entire Pacific coast of America, which was the course of Drake's journey. In my version of this story, he explores quite far north, so it takes us all the way to Alaska. You know, there was a lot to explore there, and I found that process absolutely fascinating. And the downside really is the backdrop to this story is the early years of the English involvement in the slave trade. And that is very, very upsetting to read. You know, it's horrifying, and it's important that we know about it. It's important that we read about it, but it's hard to read, very hard.
Now, Nikki, I imagine that if you're anything like me, during the course of your research, you fell down some pretty deep rabbit holes, research rabbit holes. And you mentioned that your research took you in different directions. Can you share with us something you learned in one of those moments where you were off researching some different things?
Yes, I think there were many, many, many sort of occasions when I sort of fell down rabbit holes. But I think the one that sort of took up most of my time actually was this story of you know, I've sort of mentioned it already, really, that in my version of the story, Drake's voyage takes them very far north. Now, this is kind of like the fake news of Drake's voyage, because when he got home in September 1580, everything was confiscated. His logbooks, his journals, all of the sort of records of the voyage were confiscated by the Queen, and they were locked away. Drake presented the Queen with a map showing where he'd been, and that was also afterwards later mysteriously lost. And it took 8 years, 9 years before any account of his voyage was published. And partly this is because the Queen couldn't afford to have the Spanish learn where Drake had been. She didn't want the Spanish to learn that Drake had been seeking the Northwest Passage, because the whole point of that was so that he could provide a shortcut, really, over the top of America to start challenging the Spanish all the way down the Pacific coast, which is, of course, you know, the very lucrative part of their empire. So she didn't want the Spanish to learn where he'd been. And so everything was sort of locked away, and there was no discussion of especially where he'd been in the north part of America. And so when the first account did come out, it described Nova Albion, which is the colony that Drake founded. It describes it as being about 38 degrees north, which is in California. And that is where it is sighted today. You know, there's Drake's Bay there in California, and that is the place where it is accepted that his colony was. But all of the sort of contemporary evidence points to it being much further north from that. You know, the two eyewitness accounts that I've mentioned, the anonymous narrative and John Drake's deposition, both said it was much further north than that, at around 44 to 48 degrees, which takes us into sort of Oregon, Washington, and even as far north as Vancouver. There are plenty of maps which show it this far north, and all of these maps are, you know, the contemporary maps, the ones that have been drawn and engraved by cartographers who knew Drake, they all show Nova Albion much further north. And so this became an obsession for me, because I was very interested in this idea of him being so far north, and I wanted to explore it. And so it became a sort of a real obsession. I sought out there are two surviving globes, terrestrial globes, made by Emery Molyneux, who unveiled his first globe of the world in 1592. And there's only one remaining edition of that globe, and it's in the UK at Petworth House in Sussex. So I went along to see that. And the other surviving Molyneux globe, which was made a bit later in 1603, is at Middle Temple. Again, this place which sort of keeps coming back to me with Drake. And I went to see them, and they They're absolutely extraordinary. I'd urge anyone to go and see them if they can. These beautiful globes, and both of them have the mark of Drake's voyage engraved on them. And both of them show Nova Albion much further north. In the case of the second globe, the one at Middle Temple, it shows it at 48 degrees north. So, you know, this became a sort of a little side obsession for me. And I started being interested because for a novelist, that idea of a gap is very interesting. You know, you have the facts that you want to base your story around, but where there are gaps are where you can fictionalize. And so I started being excited by this big, very big gap, you know, this idea that we don't actually know where Drake was. We don't know where his colony was. And that gave me the freedom to fictionalize more about what happens there. So yes, I would say that is the biggest rabbit hole I fell down.
But it was certainly that sounds taken... like a deep one. Yes, absolutely. And I'd never heard of those globes. So that, thank you for mentioning them. That's really fascinating. I'll have to try and see if I can find some pictures online.
Yes. Oh, they're absolutely beautiful. And you can in Middle Temple. It's in their library, and okay. Anyone can request to go and see it. And the globe at Petworth House is on public view, and it's a bit more damaged. It's a bit more difficult to see what's going on, but it is still absolutely stunning.
All right. Now, Nikki, while Maria remained frustratingly elusive, what did you discover about women who lived lives like Maria's in the colonial New World?
Well, yes, I sort of went down this road because the information about Maria was so scarce. I needed to look at lives like hers. And I wanted very much to research from own voice narratives, because this picture of Maria that we get from the sources we do have, she's very... very fleeting for a start, but also she's very dehumanized. She's always sort of described in terms of her appearance, and she's objectified. And, you know, that commonly happens when women are described by men. So I wanted to seek out own voice narratives of African women in the New World who were talking about themselves. And you might think that that would be quite a difficult thing to find. But in fact, because of the records that the Spanish kept, there is a lot of information like that out there. And I found it fascinating. You know, there are plenty of narratives of African women, both enslaved and free women in the New World. And reading these women in their own words gives you a very different idea of their lives. It gives you a very different idea of their humanity, and the agency and power they had over their own lives, even if they are in extremely limited circumstances. So there's a wonderful book called Afro-Latino Voices, which carries a lot of these narratives. And, you know, in that book, there are women doing all sorts of extraordinary things. There are enslaved women who use Spanish law. They bring lawsuits. One of the things that you could do as an enslaved person in the Spanish New World was, if you were married, you could argue to be reunited with your husband. And that's something that these women did. They may have been illiterate women, but they knew enough to use the law for their own ends. And on the other end of the scale, you see very affluent women, women who may have started life in slavery, but who had freed themselves and left wills detailing their goods to their descendants. And you get a very different idea of the agency of these women when they're listing, you know, their goods and all the things they've built up over their lives. There are wonderful narratives of a woman who was accused of witchcraft, and, you know, in reading her own words, you can see how she is sort of very cleverly sort of using her understanding of Spanish law and Spanish life to fight that charge. And she did fight it. And not only did she fight this accusation of witchcraft, she managed to free herself from slavery during this whole process. So I think when you read stories like that, you get, for me, it gave me a very different idea of Maria. It gave me an idea of a woman who would have been resourceful, very bold and creative in her sort of use of what she had available to her to improve her life. And it gave me her voice, really. It sort of led me to see her in a very different way. And it almost felt like the sort of I think reading people in their own words is so important, and it pulls you back. It sort of takes you right to that place and time in ways that sort of reading secondary sources just never will.
Absolutely, in their own voice. That's really extraordinary. So this sounds like an incredible project and an incredible journey that you've been on. So what's next, Nikki? Do you have any plans for future books?
Yes, I do. I am working on something now that's set in Minoan Crete, actually. That's another one. Oh. abiding passions. So it's set about 3,500 years ago, and it's set at the point in time when the Minoan world was crumbling. And this is really another lifelong obsession for me, really. I'm half Greek.
Right, okay.
I grew up with the Greek myths, and I spend a lot of time in Crete. So I know Crete very well, and I find it fascinating. It's going to take me a long time. I can say that, but that's what I'm working on right now.
That sounds like another extraordinary story. And I was going to say, is there an opportunity for a research trip? But it seems you've already been to Crete.
Yes, plenty of research trips. I think it would require many, many research trips, unfortunately.
Fantastic. Now, at the end of Talking Tutors, we always play what I call a little game of 10 to go. So these are just 10 questions just to get to know you a little bit better. So are you ready to do that?
Sure. Yes.
Fabulous. What was the last book that you read?
Oh, well, I'm returning to historical fiction, actually. I stayed away while I was writing because I guess I didn't want to feel, like I was mimicking anything. So I'm now returning to historical fiction in a really big way, and I'm absolutely loving it. A wonderful book called The Western Wind by Samantha Harvey, which is set in the 15th century in England, and it's sort of like a medieval whodunit. And I absolutely adored that book. It was very immediate and fascinating.
Great. Another one to add to our long TBR lists. Now, as a child, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I was a bit of a dreamer. I was a dreamer and a reader. So I didn't have any sort of great ambitions for a vocation, but I was always reading, and I used to write. I used to write these little newsletters of my weekend, which looking were incredibly boring. But I think, I would have been, it never occurred to me that that could be a job. So I think I'd have been very pleased as a child to think that one day I might write a book.
Oh, I love the sound of your newsletters. Lovely. Now, do you have any writing rituals that you follow at the moment?
I suppose I don't have any conscious rituals, but I am very much a creature of habit. I make my coffee, I sit down, and I have to have the coffee before I start writing. So I don't know if that's a ritual, but that's very much the way I work. I'm not sure if I could work without coffee.
And what's a movie that you've watched more than once that you go back to?
Oh, well, I've got three small boys, so there are plenty of Disney films that I've watched probably 1,000 times or more. Frozen. I could probably recite Frozen from start to finish. I don't get to see grown-up films.
Grown-up movies.
Much, let alone twice. I can't think of any I've seen more than once. I just saw The Favourite for the first time, and which is the story of Queen Anne. And that was a wonderful film. I loved it. I'd love to watch that again if I ever get the chance.
If you get the chance, that's right. And what was your favourite cartoon or movie as a child?
Oh, well, that has to be Dogtanyan. I don't know if you had Dogtanyan in Australia, but...
No, I don't think I've heard of that. I'll have to look that one up.
Oh, well, in a nutshell, it's the story of D'Artagnan, the musketeer, but everyone in it is a dog.
Right. Okay. There you go.
Makes sense.
Do you have a pet? I think I actually met this pet earlier on.
Oh, yes, that's Brearley. He's been evicted from the room because he's very needy and wants a lot of attention. He's a golden retriever, and he's a lovely, fluffy companion.
And what do you do to relax and recharge the batteries?
Well, actually, I would say my writing. I've got three children. That's very full-on. So for me, time spent reading and researching whatever my project is at the time, and writing is what recharges me. That's what I enjoy doing, and that's what I choose to do if I have any time available.
Nikki, a dream holiday destination?
I've always wanted to go to Petra in Jordan, and I've never been, so that's one for the future.
Sounds fantastic. Now, name someone, and just to make it a bit more fun, let's just say that they can be from the past or from now, that you'd like to sit next to on a very long international flight?
Oh, it would have to be Hilary Mantel.
She'd be fascinating.
I would feel very sorry for her because I would probably not leave her alone.
Excellent. And lucky last question, what's a piece of advice that you wish you could give your younger self?
I think I would tell myself to stop worrying about expectations or what other people are doing, and to focus on what you enjoy and to follow your curiosity and what brings you joy. And that is the thing that makes your life more enjoyable and meaningful. So I would tell myself that.
Very wise words. I agree with you. I think I'd like to tell myself, my younger self, that too. And very, very, very last thing, I promise now, and then I'll let you get on with your day, is our tutor takeaway. So I ask all my guests for something that our listeners can go and have a look at after the episode. It could be a website, a book, a song to listen to. Do you have a tutor takeaway?
I do. I've mentioned that I read a lot of Elizabethan narratives for this book.
Yes.
And out of all of those, I think the one that really just has stayed with me is the diary of Richard Maddox. And he was a chaplain on a ship not long after Drake's voyage. And it's his diary of the voyage. He was in a very similar position to Francis Fletcher, who was the chaplain on the Golden Hind, whose diary is one of the resources I've used for my book. They were both in a sort of quite similar position. They both felt that their captain, you know, in Fletcher's case, that was Drake. And in Maddox's case, it was a man called Edward Fenton. They both felt their captains were dishonourable and up to no good. And so Maddox's diary is unbelievable. He's given nicknames for everyone on the ship so he can talk about them in his journal. He writes part of his journal in cipher because he is you know, talking his true feelings about what's going on this voyage. And that's something I borrowed, actually, for Francis Fletcher in my novel. He has little anecdotes of life on the not only on the ship, but also his previous life, you know, at home in Elizabethan England. He has little jokes about a farting boy, for example, little anecdotes of life. It's just an incredibly moving portrait of a man in a very sort of extraordinary situation. You know, I'll just mention Hilary Mantel, but to me, it's very like Wolf Hall, actually, and it's the way it makes you really feel like you're there. It's very immediate. And I would sort of encourage anyone who's interested in Tudor and Elizabethan history to read his diary, because it's incredibly moving, and it reminds us what we have in common. You know, he comes across as a very modern man. He's funny, he's sarcastic, he's witty, and he's very humane. And I just think it's an absolutely wonderful, wonderful book. I should say it was published by Elizabeth Story Donohoe as an Elizabethan in 1582. The original diary is kept at the British Library, but you can get a published version of the manuscript, which is wonderful.
That does sound interesting, and we certainly haven't had that tutor takeaway before, so thank you very much. There's another fantastic book to add to the list. And Nikki, so when is your book out?
It's out on March the 16th in the UK. It will be coming out in the US later in the year. I'm not sure of the date yet. I'm not sure of the date yet for the rest of the world, but certainly available in the UK from March the 16th.
Let's make a note of that. That sounds like a wonderful novel to read. And thank you so much for taking time out of your day to talk tutors with us.
Thank you, Natalie. It was a very great pleasure.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is On The Tudor Trail, and on Instagram as The Most Happy 78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.